Welcome to Black Art is Lit. I'm your host, Nakira Cheney, and on this episode, we're reading God Help the Child by Toni Morrison. And I know I say it a lot, this is one of my favorite authors, but I do love Toni Morrison. I can remember being a teen, and I stayed inside one summer simply reading the collection of Toni Morrison books, and I was changed. I mean, I read every single one, and it was like a new world, a new character, a new depth in each and every one of those books. So I'm excited to dive into this one. So, a fierce and provocative novel, God Help the Child, the first book by Toni Morrison to be set in our current moment, weaves a tale about the way the sufferings of childhood can shape and misshape the life of the adult. At the center, a young woman who calls herself Bride, whose stunning blue-black skin is only one element of her beauty, her boldness and confidence, her success in life, but which caused her light-skinned mother to deny her even the simplest forms of love. There is Booker, the man Bride loves and loses to anger, Rain, the mysterious white child with whom she crosses paths, and finally, Bride's mother herself, Sweetness, who takes a lifetime to come to understand that what you do to children matters and they might never forget. Sweetness, it's not my fault, so you can't blame me. I didn't do it and have no idea how it happened. It didn't take more than an hour after they pulled her out from between my legs to realize something was wrong, really wrong. She was so black, she scared me. Midnight black, Sudanese black. I'm light-skinned with good hair, what we call high yellow, and so is Lula Ann's father. Ain't nobody in my family anywhere near that color. Tar is the closest I can think of, yet her hair don't go with the skin. It's different. Straight but curly like those naked tribes in Australia. You might think she's a throwback, but throwback to what? You should have seen my grandmother. She passed for white and never said another word to any of her children. Any letter she got from my mother or my aunt, she sent right back, unopened. Finally, they got the message of no message and let her be. Almost all mulatto types and quadroons did that back in the day. If they had the right kind of hair, that is. Can you imagine how many white folks have Negro blood running and hiding in their veins? Guess, 20% I heard. My own mother, Lula Mae, could have passed easy, but she chose not to. She told me the price she paid for that decision. When she and my father went to the courthouse to get married, there were two Bibles, and they had to put their hands on the one reserved for Negroes. The other one was for white people's hands, the Bible. Can you beat it? My mother was housekeeper for a rich white couple. They ate every meal she cooked and insisted they scrubbed their backs while they sat in the tub and God knows what other intimate things they made her do, but not no touching of the same Bible. Some of you probably think it's a bad thing to group ourselves according to skin color, the lighter the better. In social clubs, neighborhoods, churches, sororities, even colored schools, but how else can we hold on to a little dignity? How else can you avoid being spit on in a drugstore, shoving elbows at the bus stop, walking in the gutter to let whites have the whole sidewalk, charged a nickel at the grocer's for a paper bag that's free to white shoppers, let alone all the name calling? I heard about all of that and much, much more. But because of my mother's skin color, she wasn't stopped from trying on hats in the department stores or using their ladies' rooms. And my father could try on shoes in the front of the store, not in the back room. Neither one would let themselves drink from a colored-only fountain, even if they were dying of thirst. I hate to say it, but from the very beginning in the maternity ward, the baby, Lula Ann, embarrassed me. Her birth skin was pale like all babies, even African ones, but it changed fast. I thought I was going crazy when she turned blue-black right before my eyes. I know I went crazy for a minute because once, just for a few seconds, I held a blanket over her face and pressed. But I couldn't do that. No matter how much I wish she hadn't been born with that terrible color, I even thought of giving her away to an orphanage someplace. And I was scared to be one of those mothers who put their babies on church steps. Recently, I heard about a couple in Germany, white as snow, who had a dark-skinned baby nobody could explain. Twins, I believe. One white, one colored. But I don't know if it's true. All I know is that for me, nursing her was like having a pickaninny suck in my teat. I went to bottle feeding soon as I got home. My husband, Lewis, is a porter. And when he got back off the rails, he looked at me like I really was crazy and looked at her like she was from the planet Jupiter. He wasn't a cussing man, so when he said, "God damn, what the hell is this?" I knew we were in trouble. That's what it did it. What caused the fights between me and him. It broke our marriage to pieces. We had 3 good years together, but when she was born, he blamed me and treated Lula Ann like she was a stranger. More than that, an enemy. He never touched her. I never did convince him that I ain't never ever fooled around with another man. He dead sure I was lying. We argued and argued till I told him her blackness must be from his own family, not mine. That's when it got worse. So bad he just up and left and I had to look for another cheaper place to live. I knew enough not to take her with me when I applied to landlords, so I left her with a teenage cousin to babysit. I did the best I could and didn't take her outside much anyway, because when I pushed her in the baby carriage, friends or strangers would lean down and peek in to say something nice and then give a star or jump back before frowning. That hurt. I could have been the babysitter if our skin colors were reversed. It was hard enough just being a colored woman, even a high yellow one, trying to rent in a decent part of the city. Back in the 90s when Lula Ann was born, the law was against discriminating in who you could rent to, but not many landlords paid attention to it. They made up reasons to keep you out. But I got lucky with Mr. Lay. I know he upped the rent $7 from what he advertised, and he was a fit if a minute you was late with it. I told her to call me Sweetness instead of Mother or Mama. It was safer. Being that black and having what I think are 2 thick lips calling me Mama would confuse people. Besides, she has funny colored eyes, crow black with a blue tint, something witchy about them too. So if it was just us for a long while and I didn't have anyone to tell how hard it is being an abandoned wife, I guess Lewis felt a little bit bad after leaving us like that, because a few months later on, he found out where I moved to and started sending me money once a month. Though I never asked him to and didn't go to court to get it. His $50 money orders in my night job at the hospital got me and Lula Ann off welfare, which was a good thing. I wish they would stop calling it welfare and go back to the word they used when my mother was a girl. Then it was called relief. Sounds much better, like it's just a short-term breather while you get yourself together. Besides, those welfare checks are mean as spit. When finally I got work and didn't need them anymore, I was making more money than they ever did. I guess meanness filled out their skimpy paychecks, which is why they treated us like beggars. More so when they looked at Lula Ann and back at me, like I was cheating or something. Things got better, but I still had to be careful. Very careful in how I raised her. I had to be strict, very strict. Lula Ann needed to know how to behave, how to keep her head down and not to make trouble. I don't care how many times she changes her name, her color is a cross she will always carry. But it's not my fault. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. It's not. Bride, I'm scared. Something bad is happening to me. I feel like I'm melting away. I can't explain it to you, but I do know when it started. It began after he said, "You're not the woman I want. Neither am I." I still don't know why I said that. It just popped out of my mouth. But when he heard my sassy answer, he shot me a hateful look before putting on his jeans. Then he grabbed his boots and t-shirt. And when I heard the door slam, I wondered for a split second if he was not just ending our silly argument, but ending us, our relationship. Couldn't be. Any minute I would hear the key turn, the front door click open and close. But I didn't hear anything the whole night. Nothing at all. What? Am I not exciting enough or pretty enough? I can't have thoughts on my own, do things he doesn't approve of. By morning, soon as I woke up, I was furious. Glad he was gone, because clearly he was just using me since I had money and a crotch. I was so angry. If you would have seen me, you would have thought I had spent those 6 months with him in a holding cell without arraignment or a lawyer. And suddenly the judge called the whole thing off. dismiss the case or refuse to hear it at all. Anyway, I refused to whine, wail, or accuse. He said one thing, I agreed. Besides, our affair wasn't all that spectacular. Not even the mildly dangerous stuff I used to let myself enjoy. Well, anyway, it was nothing like those double-page spreads in fashion magazines, you know. Couples standing half-naked and surf, looking so free and downright mean. Their sexuality like lightning and the sky going dark to show off the shine of their skin. I love those ads. But our affair didn't measure up to any old R&B song. Some tune with the beat arranged to generate fever. It wasn't even the sugary lyrics of a 30s blues song, "Baby, baby, why you treat me so? I do anything you say, go anywhere you want me to go." Why I kept comparing us to magazine spreads and music, I can't say, but it tickled me to settle one. I want to dance with somebody. It was raining the next day. Bullet taps on the windows followed by crystal lines of water. I avoided the temptation to glance through the panes at the sidewalk beneath my condo. Besides, I knew what was out there. Nasty-looking palm trees lining the road. Benches in that tacky little park, few, if any, pedestrians. A sliver of sea far beyond. I fought giving in to any wish that he was coming back. When a tiny ripple of missing him surfaced, I beat it back. Around noon, I opened a bottle of Pinot Grigio and sank into the sofa. It swayed in silk cushions as comfy as any arms, almost. Because I have to admit, he is one beautiful man, flawless even. Except for a tiny scar on his upper lip and an ugly one on his shoulder. An orange-red blob with a tail. Otherwise, head to toe, he is one gorgeous man. I'm not so bad myself, so imagine how we looked as a couple. After a glass or two of wine, I was a little buzzed and decided to call my friend Brooklyn, tell her all about it. How he hit me harder than a fist with six words, "You not the woman I want." How they rattled me so I agreed with them, so stupid. But then I changed my mind about calling her. You know how it is, nothing new. Just he walked out and I don't know why. Besides, too much was happening at the office for me to bother my best friend and colleague with gossip about another breakup. Especially now. I'm regional manager now, and that's like being a captain, so I have to maintain the right relationship with the crew. Our company, Sylvia Inc., is a small cosmetic business, but it's beginning to blossom and making waves, finally, and shedding its frumpy past. It used to be corsets for discriminating women back in the 40s, but changed its name and ownership to Sylvia Apparel, then Sylvia Inc., before going flat out hit with six cool cosmetic lines, one of which is mine. I called it You Girl. Cosmetics for your personal millennium. It's for girls and women of all complexions, from ebony to lemonade to milk, and it's mine, all mine. The idea, the brand, the campaign. Wiggling my toes under the silk cushion, I couldn't help smiling at the lipstick smile on my wine glass, thinking, how about that, Lula Ann? Did you ever believe you would grow up to be this hot or this successful? Maybe she was the woman he wanted. But Lula Ann Bridewell is no longer available, and she was never a woman. Lula Ann was a 16-year-old me who dropped that dumb countrified name as soon as I left high school. I was Ann Bride for 2 years until I interviewed for a sales job at Sylvia Inc. and on a hunt shortened my name to Bride. With nothing anybody needs to say before or after that one memorable syllable. Customers and reps like it, but he ignored it. He called me baby most of the time. Hey baby, come on baby, and sometimes you my girl. Accent on the my. The only time he said woman was the day he split. The more white wine, the more I thought good riddance. No more dallying with a mystery man with invisible means of support. An ex-felon, if ever there was one, though he laughed when I teased him about how he spent his time when I was at the office. Idle? Roaming? Meeting someone? He said his Saturday afternoon trips downtown were not reports to a probation officer or drug rehabilitation counselor, yet he never told me what they were. I told him every single thing about myself. He confided nothing. So I just made stuff up with TV plots. He was an informant with a new identity, a disbarred lawyer. Whatever. I didn't really care. Actually, the timing of his leaving was perfect for me. With him gone out of my life and out of my apartment, I can concentrate on the launch of You Girl. And it's especially important, keep a promise I made to myself long before I met him. We fought about it the night that he said, "You not the woman." According to prisoninfo.org, it was time. I've been planning this trip for a year, choosing carefully what a parolee would need. I saved up $5,000 in cash over the years and brought a $3,000 Continental Airlines gift certificate. I put a promotional box of You Girl into a brand new Louis Vuitton shopping bag, all of which could take her anywhere, comfort her anyway, help her forget and take the edge off bad luck, hopelessness, and boredom. Well, maybe not boredom. No prison is a convict. He didn't understand why I was so set on going, and the night when we quarreled about my promise, he ran off. I guess I threatened his ego by doing some good Samaritan thing not directed at him. Selfish bastard. I paid the rent, not him, and the maid too. When we went to clubs and concerts, we rolled in my beautiful Jaguar or in cars I hired. I bought him beautiful shirts, although he never wore them, and did all the shopping. Besides, a promise is a promise, especially if it's to oneself. It was when I got dressed for the drive I noticed the first peculiar thing. Every bit of my pubic hair was gone. Not gone as in shaved or waxed, but gone as in erased. As in never having been there in the first place. It scared me, so I threaded through the hair on my head to see if it was shedding, but it was thick and slippery as it had always been. Allergy? Skin disease, maybe. It worried me, but there was no time to do more than be anxious and plan to see a dermatologist. I had to be on my way to make it on time. I suppose other people might like the scenery bordering this highway, but it's so thick with lanes, exits, and parallel roads, overpasses, cautionary signs, and signs. It's like being forced to read a newspaper while driving. Annoying. Along with amber alerts, silver and gold ones were springing up. I stayed in the right lane and slowed down because from past drives out this way, I knew the Norristown exit was easy to mix and the prison had no sign of its existence in the world for a mile beyond the exit ramp. I guess they didn't want tourists to know that some of the reclaimed desert, California, is famous for holding evil women. The Women's Correctional Center right outside of Norristown, owned by a private company, is worshipped by the locals for the work it provides. Serving visitors, guards, clerical staff, cafeteria workers, healthcare folks, and most of all, construction laborers repairing the road and fences, aiding wing after wing to house the increasing flood of violent, sinful women committing bloody female crimes. Lucky for the state, crime does pay. The couple of times I drove out before, I never tried to get inside on some pretext or another. Back then, I just wanted to see where the lady monster, that's what they called her, had been caged for 15 of her 25 to life sentence. This time was different. She has been granted parole, and according to penal review notices, Sophia Huxley is going to strut through the bars I pushed her behind. You'd think, with DragonCon being all that corporate money, that a Jaguar wouldn't stand out. But behind the curbside buses, old Toyotas, and secondhand trucks, my car is sleek, rat gray with the vanity license, looked like a gun. But it was not as sinister as the white limousines I'd seen parked there. Engines roaring, chauffeurs leaning against gleaming fenders. Tell me, who would need a driver leaping to open the door and make a quick getaway? A grand madam impatient to get back to her designer linens and her tasteful high-rise brothel? Or maybe a teenage hookerette, eager to get back to the patio of some sumptuous, degenerate private club where she could celebrate her release among friends by ripping up prison-issue underwear. No Sylvia Inc. products for her? Our line is sexy enough but not expensive enough. Like all sex trash, the little hookerette would think the higher the price, the better the quality. If she only knew. Still, she might buy some. You Girl sparkle eyeshadow or gold fleck lip gloss. No limousines today unless you count the Lincoln Town car. Mostly just worn Toyotas and ancient Chevys, silent grown-ups and jittery children. An old man sitting at the bus stop is digging into a box of Cheerios, trying to find the last circle of Sweet Oak brand. He's wearing ancient wingtip shoes and Christian linen jeans. His baseball cap, his brown vest over a white shirt, cream Salvation. But his manner is superior, dainty even. His legs are crossed and he examines the bitter dry cereal as though it were a choice grape picked especially for him by groundkeepers to the throne. 4 o'clock, it won't be long now. Huxley Sophia, a.k.a. 007-1140, won't be released during visiting hours. At exactly 4:30, only the town car is left, owned probably by a lawyer with an alligator briefcase full of papers, money, and cigarettes. The cigarettes for his client, the money for the witness, and papers to look like he's working. Are you okay, Lula Ann? The prosecutor's voice was soft, encouraging, but I could barely hear her. There's nothing to be afraid of. She can't hurt you. No, she can't. And damn, here she is, number 007-1140. Even after 15 years, I could never mistake her simply because of her height, 6 feet at least. Nothing has shrunk the giant I remember, who was taller than the bailiff, the judge, the lawyers, and almost as tall as the police. Only her co-monster husband matched her height. Nobody doubted she was the filthy freak that parents shaking with anger called her. Look at her eyes, they whispered, everywhere in the courtroom. Ladies' room, on benches lining the hall, they whispered, cold like the snake she is, at 20. How could a 20-year-old do things to children? Are you kidding? Just look at those eyes, old as dirt. My little boy would never get over it. Devil. Now those eyes are more like a rabbit's than a snake's, but the height is the same. A whole lot else has changed. She is as thin as a rope. Size 1 panties, A cup bra if any, and she could sure use some glam glow. Former eyes, wrinklers, softener, and juicy brines would give color to the whey color of her skin. When I step out of the Jaguar, I don't wonder or care whether she recognizes me. I just walk over to her and say, need a lift? She throws me a quick, uninterested glance and turns her gaze to the road. No, I don't. Her mouth is trembling. It used to be a hard, straight razor like a little Botox and some Tango Man, not glitter, would have softened her lips and maybe influenced the jury in her favor, except there was no you girl back then. Somebody picking you up? I smile. Taxi, she says. Funny, she is answering a stranger dutifully like she's used to it. No. What's it to you? Or even, who the hell are you? But going on to explain further. Called a cab. I mean, the desk did. When I come closer and reach out to touch her arm, the cab rolls up and fast as a bullet, she grabs the door handle, tosses in her little carrier bag, and slams the door shut. I bang on the window shouting, wait, wait. Too late, the driver negotiates the U-turn like a NASCAR pro. I rush to my car, following them isn't hard. I even pass the taxi to disguise the fact that I'm telling her. That turns out to be a mistake. Just as I'm about to enter the exit ramp, I see the taxi shoot ahead of me toward Norristown. Gravel pings my wheels as I brake, reverse, and follow them. The road to Norristown is lined with neat uniform houses built in the 50s and added on repeatedly. A closed side porch, a garage expanded for 2 cars, backyard patio. The road looks like a kindergarten drawing of light blue, white, or yellow houses with pine green or beet red doors sitting smugly on wine lawns. All that is missing is a pancake sun with raised sticks all around it. Beyond the house is next to a mall as pale and sad as light beer. A sign announces the beginning of the town. Next to it, another bigger sign for the Eva Dean's Motel and Restaurant. The taxi turns and stops by the entrance. She gets out and pays the driver. I follow and park a ways back near the restaurant. Only one other car is in the parking area, a black SUV. I'm sure she is meeting someone. But after a few minutes at the check-in desk, she goes straight to the restaurant and takes a seat by the window. I can see her clearly and watch her study the menu like a remedial or English as a second language student, lip reading, running her finger over the items. What a change. This is the teacher who had kindergarten cut apples into rings to shape the letter O, doled out pretzels as B's, slit watermelon chunks into Y, all to spell boy, who she liked best according to the women whispering in front of the sinks in a ladies' room. Fruit as bait was a big part of the trial's testimony. Look at her eat. The waitress keeps placing plate after plate in front of her. Makes sense, sort of, this first out-of-prison meal. She's gobbling like a refugee, like somebody who's been floating at sea without food or water for weeks and just about to wonder what harm it would do to his dying boatmate to taste his flesh before it shrank. She never takes her eyes from the food, stabbing, slicing, scooping. She drinks no water, butters no bread, as though nothing is allowed to delay her speed eating. The whole thing is over in 10 or 12 minutes. Then she pays, leaves, and hurries down the walkway. Now what? Key in hand, tote bag on her shoulder, she stops and turns to a break between two walls. I get out of the car and walk run behind her until I hear the retching sounds of vomit. So I hide behind the SUV until she comes out. And that is the beginning of God Help the Child. Please go out and read it. Check it out. It gets really, really good. Really interesting. Some things will have you scratching your head because I definitely did. Again, I'm Nakira, and I thank you for tuning in to another episode of Black Art is Lit.